This is Fresh Air. I'm Ken Tucker, critic at large for Entertainment Weekly, sitting in for Terry Gross. Jonathan Kellerman is a best-selling mystery writer and an accomplished child psychologist. Kellerman was the founding director of the psychosocial program at Children's Hospital of Los Angeles. He cared for sick children and researched how they dealt with chronic illness, hospitalization, pain, and anxiety. His first novel, When the Bough Breaks, was a bestseller, making it possible for him to write full-time, although he still teaches at the University of Southern California School of Medicine. New York Times crime book columnist Marilyn Stasio wrote that Kellerman's singular touch with wounded children paid off royally in Billy Strait, a brisk suspense thriller. It's now in paperback. The story is about a street kid who witnesses a murder and finds himself in jeopardy. Here's a reading from the opening page. Billy has been sleeping in the park and awakes to witness a horrifying scene.
First, the car drove up to the edge of the parking lot. They got out and talked, and he grabbed her, like in a hug. I thought maybe they were going to kiss, and I'd watch that. Then all of a sudden she made a weird sound, surprised, squeaky, like a cat or a dog that gets stepped on. He let go of her, and she fell. Then he bent down next to her, and his arm started moving up and down really fast. I thought he was punching her, and that was bad enough. And I kept thinking, should I do something? But then I heard another sound, fast, wet, like the butcher at Stater Brothers back in Watson chopping meat. Chuck, chuck, chuck. He kept doing it, moving his arm up and down. I wasn't breathing. My heart was on fire. My legs were cold. Then they turned hot, wet, pissing my pants like a stupid baby. The chuck, chuck stopped. He stood up, big and wide, wiped his hands on his pants. Something was in his hand and held it far from his body. He looked all around, then in my direction. Could he see me, hear me? Smell me? He kept looking. I wanted to run, but knew he'd hear me. But staying here could trap me. How could he see anything behind the rocks?
That's Jonathan Kellerman reading from his new novel, Billy Strait. Tell us what Billy has actually seen.
Billy has seen a vicious murder of a woman in a park, in Griffith Park, where he's been living. He's a runaway, and he's been surviving in the urban jungle of Los Angeles, living in a park. And he's witnessed a terrible, terrible crime.
He keeps hearing that chuck, chuck sound of the stabbing. Do you think it's particularly true for kids that the bad things they've witnessed get replayed and replayed in their minds in a terrifying way?
Absolutely. I think repetition is a very important form of childhood, not just in the sense of trauma, but also in the sense of therapy. When I worked as a psychologist, I became aware of the curative value of repetition, in the sense that children will just, for example, if they're frightened by a movie, will see it over and over and over again until it's desensitized.
Wow, I'm glad you mentioned that. I did that when I was a kid.
We all did. That's why
it's kids... how I learned to love horror movies.
Exactly. And parents make this mistake. They say, well, you were scared by it the first time, so you can't see it again. It's really the worst thing they could do, because the child will often engage in self-therapy and really systematically desensitize him or herself to the frightening stimulus.
You worked as a child psychologist before you became a novelist.
Right.
Or before you became published as a novelist.
Published novelist, right.
That's right. When you worked as a psychologist full-time, did you know you also wanted to write?
Yes, I've been writing compulsively since the age of 9, and I actually wrote before I became a psychologist. I really never saw writing as a job. It was just a passion, and it was just a love. I won a literary prize in college and got an agent at the age of 21 and proceeded to write a lot of books, never got published. So I was really a failed writer with a good day job. I just always had dual interest in art and science. I'm a painter, and I play music, and I just love to write, but I also loved science. So I gravitated towards psychology, and I guess the unifying thread in writing fiction and practicing psychology is a curiosity about people.
Does that curiosity play out differently as a writer than it does as a child psychologist?
Yeah, I think the two fields play out in a diametrically opposite manner. I like to think of psychology as dealing with the rules of human behavior. As psychologists, we're always trying to predict human behavior. And to me, writing fiction is dealing with the exceptions to the rules. That's what interests me. In fact, Billy Strait came out of that because it was an attempt to write about a very special type of street kid who didn't go the way of other street kids. And it was, in some sense, a super coper. And very, very fascinated with people who managed to rise above the bad luck that fate has given them.
You know, you say as a child psychologist, you're more interested in the rules of human behavior. I guess I don't think of there being real rules.
Well, you know, science is all about rules, and psychology would like to be a science. And when you talk about rules, you're basically, all science strives to predict. That's its goal. Psychology is a soft science, which to some extent is what I love about it, because it's ambiguous. I would never want to be a surgeon. It's too concrete. But we are striving to learn about ways in which people behave and to predict. So there is a regularity. Now, the rules are not as ironclad, but there are certain ways of predicting, I think. But fiction is just the opposite. Who wants to write about the same old stuff? We really want to write about what's different and what's novel.
Did you come across stories as a child psychologist that would have made good cases for your detectives?
Every day. I think what finally helped me get published as a novelist was my experiences as a psychologist. But all that said, I could never ever write about a patient or even come close to it because of confidentiality. I took it very, very, very seriously, and I bent over backwards never to write about real people. That's not a problem because the fun of fiction is making it up. But I think what psychology did was it gave me just an experiential base. So hopefully, if I want to write about a kid in a situation, and I've seen 1,000 kids in that situation, hopefully it lends an air of verisimilitude and authenticity to what I'm doing.
Well, let's look at your new novel, Billy Straight. You know, Billy is a kid from a neglectful and abusive home who's now living on the streets of Los Angeles. And as you say, he's a real coper. He's very smart, not in a school educated kind of way, but he is very smart. Have you met kids like that?
Absolutely. Well, you know, the book came out of so many different places, but one of them was my experiences dealing with children in a variety of traumatic situations. I dealt with street kids. I dealt with seriously ill kids, and there were always a few children who survived in a super way. Survivors, and they always managed to rise above things and to do much better than anyone expected. Robert Coles, a psychiatrist, has written books about that. I had the chance to review some of those books for the Los Angeles Times many years ago, and I was struck with the similar stories of children growing up in the slums of Rio, managing to maintain not only a survival, but to rise above it, to transcend it, to maintain a moral vision. So what I tried to do with Billy Straight is create a character in which, even though fate casts him in a situation where he's forced to do things that he doesn't like, amoral and immoral things, he's always struggling to maintain a moral vision and a constancy.
You were the founding director of the psychosocial program at Children's Hospital of Los Angeles.
Right.
And one of the things you specialized in there was the care of seriously ill children and their families. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about children's conceptions of disease and death.
My first job, actually, was working with children who were put in these plastic bubbles, these isolation rooms for intensive chemotherapy, and people wanted to explore the psychological ramifications, and they asked me to do it, and as well as to care for these children and their families. And I said, sure, but what's the previous research? And they said, well, there is none. We're inventing the wheel. So I was really privileged to do it, and I learned a lot about how children respond. And one of the things that we started doing in the mid-70s was to talk very openly to children about the disease and the diagnosis. And that met a lot of resistance, but that is essentially the state of the art today. One thing I'm very proud of is my team really basically helped to pioneer the model of psychosocial care that is still used. And once again, children react to it very, very differently depending upon developmental stage. I think, once again, with a six-year-old child or younger, they tended to react in terms of missing their parents, separation, the isolation. So when you deal in a therapeutic sense with a child of that age, you want to minimize the separation. You want to get the parent in the hospital as much as possible. So we instituted boarding in and sleeping in programs. Latency age children, 7 to 11, 12, were very concerned about pain and suffering, and of course all kids are, but especially it was magnified at those stages. And so we emphasize a lot of pain control programs. And the adolescents were more involved in philosophical issues, had a more adult conception. We dealt with death and dying, but one of the rewarding aspects of the work was we dealt a lot with psychosocial rehab because kids were living longer. And today it's even better. Leukemia is basically curable at this point. Most children survive many, many years, if not outright cure. So in that sense, we were dealing with helping them adapt. Things like getting them back in school. How does a kid who's lost his hair go back to school, dealing with peers, dealing with siblings? It was wonderful, wonderful work.
You must have talked to the children a lot about what their ideas of death were.
Right.
And I wonder if you could share with us some of the more interesting ideas to you. Interesting because they were especially poetic or horrifying.
Well, you know, the fascinating thing is children, as their thoughts develop, progress from concrete to abstract. I'll give you a good example. We had a little boy who came in, and he was about 3 or 4 years old, and his mother came to us on a consultation because he was having horrible nightmares. And he just wake up screaming about bugs and insects and spiders, and he couldn't understand where this was coming from. And we did some therapy, some play therapy, and we found out that what had happened is he had asked someone, "What's the matter with me?" And they said, "Oh, you have a bug," using the colloquial expression, "you have a bug." Uh-huh. And once we're able to correct that and give him accurate information at his age level to explain to him what was going on at his age level, and that meant actually showing his blood under a microscope, showing the blood cells, not doing it in a scary way, the nightmare stopped. And so one thing that I learned back in the 70s was the mind abhors a vacuum. If you don't present accurate information to children, they will supply their own, and usually their fantasies are much worse than reality. So we were encouraged, and we found that parents who dealt in an open but age-appropriate manner with their children tended to have fewer adjustment problems, which is not to say we'd ever tell a child you're going to die or deal with it, because we didn't know, and that wasn't always true, and many kids didn't. But we'd like to teach them about the concrete details of their disease so they could assume more control and more understanding. And I think it involves a lot of sensitivity. It involves pacing. The science of psychotherapy is knowing what to say. The art of psychotherapy is A, knowing when not to say it, and B, timing it. So it's not an easy thing you can cookbook. It takes training. But once you focus on the humanity within the child, you're able to figure out how to communicate. But the goal was clearly communication and to prevent these kinds of fantasies.
Jonathan Kellerman, his latest book is Savage Spawn, Reflections on Violent Children. We'll continue in a moment. This is Fresh Air. We're listening to an interview with author Jonathan Kellerman by Terry Gross. They spoke earlier this year, several months after 5 people were killed in a shooting spree by 2 young boys outside a middle school in Jonesboro, Arkansas.
Now, you've not only studied and worked with children who are very vulnerable because they're sick or because they're abused. You've also written about, and I imagine have worked with, children who are very violent.
Right. I have a book coming out in October called Savage Spawn, Reflections on Violent Children. I worked with psychopathic children, sociopathic kids. Not that many, thank God, but I've had enough experience to know what they're like. And this book really grew out of my horror at that Arkansas shooting, the Jonesboro shooting, where the 2 little boys ambushed their classmates. It wasn't just the violence, but it was the premeditation, the coldness of it that I found very, very shocking and very, very chilling. And I just decided to sit down and explore the origins of this kind of violence in kids to see if I could learn from the existing literature as well as draw upon my own clinical experiences and to posit some possible answers to the question. And what I learned was eye-opening. I mean, I learned a variety of things. But, for example, one thing that I learned is I don't believe media violence is a big or very significant ingredient in the equation. The most common knee-jerk reaction when there's an outbreak of child violence is to blame the media and talk about how violent the media image is. And when you look at it closely, that doesn't pan out as a significant predictor.
What makes you say that?
Well, there are 1,000 correlative studies and not one causal link. And one thing people not trained in science often don't understand is that correlation is not causation. If I could just get into it briefly, correlation is a statistical association between 2 events, meaning that if A occurs, B is more likely to occur. That's a positive correlation. And if A occurs, B is less likely to occur as a negative correlation. So some correlations are causative. For example, smoking. Smoking is correlated with cancer and it causes cancer. But blue eyes and blonde hair are correlated and they don't cause each other. And the fact is that 99.9% of children watch television and watch movies, but very, very few of them become criminals. And so it's really hard to tie in. And most of the studies do things like show kids some movies and give them a questionnaire about violence. But that doesn't relate to actual serious murderous violence. And when you look at those kids, sure, they watch stuff. And there is some evidence that the more disturbed kids are more likely to watch violence on television. But what's really at play are things that correlate that are much more important, and namely some biological factors as well as chaotic families. It's a classic case of nature nurture. If you look at kids who actually murder and kill, you find a high rate of brain damage indicators. You find attentional deficit, learning disabilities, median IQ of 90, documented head in a head trauma. Just a lot of neurological signs, and you find chaotic families and parents, particularly fathers with a history of violence. And then you combine that with access to weapons, and that's generally what seems to bring about this type of violence. For example, the Jonesboro shooting, if these kids hadn't had access to automatic weapons, to speed loaders, and known how to use them at a very young age, would not have been a massacre. It would have been possibly a stabbing of one child, which is terrible, or a pushing and shoving. But when you throw in the access to weaponry with a kid with the nature-nurture tendency to violence, you get a really bad, bad situation.
Jonathan Kellerman is my guest, and his new novel is called Billy Straight. Kellerman is both a child psychologist and a best-selling detective writer. Now, your wife, Faye Kellerman, is also a best-selling writer, and I understand that you both initially kept it a secret from each other, the writing?
Well, mine was not a secret. She knew me. Faye and I were married very, very young, and she knew me as a failed writer with a good day job for many, many years. Faye kept her writing secretly. I mean, she watched me struggle, basically. Faye, I like to say she trained perfectly for a career as a novelist. She has a bachelor's degree in theoretical math, and she has a doctorate in dentistry. So, I mean, I never imagined she had any sort of literary talent, and I saw her as the chemistry, math, physics, hard science person. She's a very, very brilliant mathematician, and I saw myself as the artsy guy. And so it was a fascinating thing because we'd been married for 13 years when I sold my my first novel, and I was still in practice as a psychologist for the first three novels, so I was gone. And when I'd leave, she'd sneak off and work on this book, and I had no idea. And I would come home and see her working, and she'd hide it, and I figured maybe she's working on a diary of some kind. And then one day she just thrust a manuscript at me and said, "Read it, you won't like it." And I said to myself, she's absolutely right, because how could she possibly have any talent? Because I had seen her as this math science person. So it was a real lesson to me on the need to be open-minded. You think you know someone, and you really don't.
Boy, what went through your mind when you said, read it? When she said, read it, you won't like it. Were you worried that you wouldn't like it and would have no idea what to say?
Oh, yeah. I said, this is going to be horrible. She obviously can't possess talent. She's never even written a laundry list. What the hell has she done here? I'm going to have to let her down. We're going to have a big fight. As a matter of fact, I was sitting there with our third child who was born then, and the baby was sleeping on my shoulder, and I'm reading the script, and I get into it. And I'm realizing this is coherent, and I was just shocked. So I start to read it, and I'm caught up, and I'm reading, I'm turning pages, and I call her, and I say, honey, and she sheepishly comes in looking really upset. And I say, this is really good. And she says, no, it's not. I say, yes, it is. No, it's not. And we had a big fight about that. She thought I was patronizing her. So I backed it up, and I said, I'm going to call my agent. And now, you need to understand, I was not a household word, certainly in publishing, if I am indeed now. I had just sold my first novel. It hadn't come out. I called my agent. I said, I know what it sounds like, but my wife wrote a book. And he told me his eyes rolled all the way back in his head. But he said, sure, send it. And he sold it. He sold her first novel, The Ritual Bath, in 3 weeks. So it was an amazing story.
Now, does she read your novels before they're published? And if so, do you prefer an honest, critical appraisal or the more supportive, you're the greatest, dear?
Well, honesty is a kind of a malleable term here. You know, I'm Jewish. In Judaism, we have a concept of peace, that true honesty is peace. But it's interesting because neither Faye nor I came out of the English department, and here we are both novelists. So we started to read each other's stuff on a weekly basis. And as Faye says, there are often some very cold nights. We didn't know how to do this. This was a skill we were ill-prepared for. And when you criticize someone's creative work, it's akin almost to criticizing your child. The fortunate thing is that we both really love each other's work. I mean, I could love Faye and despise her writing. I happen to really love her writing. So we're approaching it from the aspect of a fan. All that said, we do tell the other if we feel something needs to be changed. And it goes well. Generally, it's, oh, this is great, but you might think about this, this, this. And this has been expanded because my son's working on his first novel, our son. And especially,
have you called your agent yet?
I haven't called, but you know, I honestly think it's publishable. He's a brilliant writer. He's actually sold a short story. He's quite good. And he emails me the chapters from college, and I read them. And once again, I like them very, very much. But if there is something he wants me to point out, I try to do it in a really diplomatic way. And I think if you're approaching it from a perspective of positivity and support, some of these writing, you know, the writers' groups get very nasty because there's this agenda. Faye and I don't have that because we are very supportive. Even so, it can get tough. It's a tough situation, but we work hard at doing it well.
Well, Jonathan Kellerman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Jonathan Kellerman speaking earlier this year with Terry Gross. His novel, Billy Straight, is now in paperback. This is Fresh Air.